Bible, please, tonight at 2 Chronicles 31. Please. Second Chronicles 31. Hezekiah is the king at hand, and of course, if you follow through the chronology of the kings, beginning with Asa, there's a whole slew of them until we finally arrive at this man. And even going back to King David and to Solomon, we find a common thread of instruction that I think is foundational to something that I believe that you and I would really delight in, and that is to be able to have a sense of advancement personally and as a church family. We take our cue tonight from the 21st verse in there. It's at the conclusion of everything prior to Sennacherib's little thing here. It says of this king that in every work that he began in the service of the house of God and in the law and in the commandments to seek his God, he did it with all his heart and prospered. Prospered conveys the idea of an advancement, to be able to push forward, profitable, fruitful, useful, faithful. And I think that that's probably what that we would like for ourselves. And there's a bit of an instruction here that I think will lay the foundation for the third and final segment of the series I've been doing on Sunday mornings, where our focus is going to shift upward. And here we see where Hezekiah is said to have sought his God. To sought his God. And I want to put that in a larger, broader setting. If you'll go back to the 14th chapter of this same book, the 14th chapter, where Asa is the principal here. I think if we lay the foundation for advancement, it is basically this. If we seek God, we prosper. And by prospering, I don't mean becoming necessarily extravagantly wealthy, so much as there is a sense of well-being in your heart and mind that we are pushing forward in the Christian life. We might say, like the Apostle Paul would phrase it, to have a sense of the reality of our growing in grace. But in this 14th chapter, it is said of this time in the kingdom, that there was quiet. And that word is repeated many times in this particular very small context. Quiet 10 years. And then it says of Asa, he did that which was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. Took away the altars of the strange gods, the high places. He broke down the images, cut down the groves, commanded Judah to seek the Lord God of their fathers. Now, please understand there, you have to make a little clarification. In the era of the church, you don't command people to seek God. You just don't. You can suggest it to them. It's very good that you do. You can encourage them. You can harass them over it, politely and kindly. But you can't command them. And the reason is that we don't live in a theocracy. Asa was part of a kingdom, a theocracy, in a position where he could command an external activity, but it could in no way determine the internal reality of the action that appears outwardly. That's all he could do. He could come in, and everybody could would give an appearance that they are crying out to God in prayer, that they are relying on Him and trusting in all Him, but there's no way, Old Testament or New Testament, that you can, or any man, king, president, emperor, pastor, father, uncle, whatever, there's no possible way to command the internal seeking of God. When we think about this idea of seeking God, you probably, maybe I won't even go on that line of thought. It's too raw in a sense, but the idea is to, it conveys a picture of wearing down a path because it is frequently tread over and over and over and over. If you have carpeted any part of your home and you have for years had furniture fixed in a certain place and you walk in a certain place, it's going to wear more visibly there than if you pull things away from the wall where you never walk. And it probably would be a good, I think, to pull everything into the center of your room and walk on the side so that you get a nicer feel. But when people frequently travel the same path, it cuts a groove. And the idea of seeking God, in the proper sense where it is an internal reality that conforms to the external action, then it is like wearing a groove out, cutting a path out. It is easily observable, not only to you so that you can always find your way, but should somebody inquire as to what might be going on in your life with regard to your God, they can easily mark the path you take. And it is here said that he commanded Judah to seek the Lord. That's all he could do, the external action. And verse 5 says, he took away out of all the cities of Judah the high places and the images, and the kingdom, again, was quiet before him. Quiet. Verse 6, he built fenced cities in Judah. The land had rest. And he had no war in those years because the Lord had given him rest. If you do a little bit of thinking about why the Lord would have done that, I think it is true whether it's an Old Testament theocrat or whether it's a New Testament Christian. God always blesses obedience. Always he blesses obedience. And what you see in the verses just that we've just read is a profound display of piety on the part of the king. And so because he did what he did, God gave him and the nation, or the Judah, rest. Then comes to verse 7. Therefore he said unto Judah, let us build these cities and make about them walls and towers and gates and bars while the land is yet before us. Now, may I ask you this, just maybe it's too obvious of a question. Why would you go to all the trouble of preparing fenced cities when everything is at ease? It's been quiet for 10 years. What tends to happen in the human mind when things sort of remain static, day after day, month after month, year after year, everything is easy? If that being the case, why build fences? Why would the king have gone to the trouble to build the fences? There was no war, according to verse 6, because the Lord had given him rest. So why would you think it necessary in a time of peace and quiet to go to all the trouble of making preparation for war? Verse 7, we come back to that. Let us build these cities, make about them walls, towers, gates. And by the way, I'm going to answer the question I just asked you. The answer to that question is because you and I in this era, as ambassadors for Christ, we are have been placed by the sovereign God of heaven in a foreign outpost. And the territory that we live and move and have our being in and serve in belongs to the devil. And so we must always be on war footing, even if no bullets are being fired. There must always be, on the part of the Christian, according to Paul's counsel in Ephesians 6, always put the armor of God on. Why? Why put the armor on if nobody's throwing spears at you? Well, because you're vulnerable. At all times vulnerable. We don't wrestle against flesh and blood. No matter how nasty they may appear or look, no matter how much they may nauseate you, you don't wrestle against flesh and blood so much as you wrestle against the prince of the power of the air. You are likely to be shot at any time, so to speak. And so there's necessary preparations made. And he says, because we make these walls and towers, gates and bars while the land is yet before us, because we have sought the Lord our God, we have sought Him, and He hath given us rest on every side. And so it says that they built and they prospered. They built and they prospered. Probably nothing more frustrating, especially if you are the primary beneficiary of someone's constructive labors. You buy a piece of property, you want to put a house on there or another building, and you contract to have it done, and the guy says, I'll be there at a certain day, and you ask, well, how long will it take? And he says, oh, you'll be under roof and operating inside there within 6 months, and you go, great, let's go for it. And third month comes by, and he hasn't showed up yet. There's been no progress, no site preparation, nothing. Did you get any permits yet? Did you make arrangements for the sand? No, didn't do anything. Well, you said 6 months from the time. Well, yeah, from the time I start. Well, a little change in direction here. And everybody's frustrated. But here we see that when they started the construction, God made them to prosper. He pushed it forward so that all of the projects that were necessary in the eyes of the king were authenticated or validated by God Himself, and they prospered. They moved forward. They advanced their agenda. Now, it is that our God always is on time, and He and everything He permits into your life and mine is always done in a timely fashion. And so it is said that they prospered, and it says Asa had an army of men that bare targets and spears out of Judah, 300,000. Out of Benjamin that bare shields and drew bows, 280,000. And all these were mighty men of valor. Now that's great when that's a peacetime standing army. And then, of course, verse 9 comes in. Not to take God by surprise, and not a moment too early, a moment too late, there came out against them Zerah. And so a battle ensues. And please notice, again, the practicality or the definition of seeking God. Now please notice that it is said that the king and the people sought God in times of peace. What is the typical human response when things are easy, I ask you? When things are well, people tend to, I don't want to say forget God, but God somehow is not on the front burner. But the minute there's a splash in the puddle, everybody all of a sudden gets down on their knees and they go for it. But these people sought God in time of peace. God gave them rest. And in the process of that rest, the time was used wisely so as to prepare for the eventuality that there would come one day, as permitted by God, to assault them. And so what does he do? Well, he doesn't do anything different in verse 11 than what he had been doing previous. It says, he cried unto the Lord his God. And here's the substance of his prayer. Lord, it is nothing with thee, nothing with thee to help. Whether with many or with them that have no power. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rest on thee. We rely on thee. And in thy name we go against this multitude. O Lord, thou art our God. Let not man prevail against we. What? Thee. Convey your thoughts on the difference between we and thee. I mean, who's going to do the fighting, them or God? Who's going to do the fighting? Does God need soldiers with shields and spears? So, who's going to do the fighting in this instance? How do you know that from the text? Huh? The Lord smote the Ethiopians. And then Johnny come lately. Here comes Asa in verse number 13. They pursued. Now, we have seen examples in the scriptures where God, without any human instrumentality, defeated the enemy. Other times, God is pleased to use the means to an end to defeat the enemy. In this particular case, I don't read of any casualties whatever, and we see that a lot of times when God undertakes for his people. There are massive casualties on the part of the enemy, but zero on the part of the army of God. On the other hand, I've seen it also when the army of the people of God step out of the will of God and seek to operate in the realm of the flesh, they suffer the casualties, and the enemy has zero. God is in perfect control. His timing is always appropriate. So they pursued the Ethiopians. They couldn't recover, and they carried away much spoil. Now, back up to say all this. When we look at this little portion in chapter 14, it seems to me that a standalone practice that they took, these godly line of kings took as far back as David and Solomon, was that they were in a pattern of resorting to God continually, resorting to him continually. And secondly, there was predictable, and I say predictable from the eyes of God, predictable results. When I look at all of that, I come back again at this last verse we looked at in verse 11, and we see that there is the result and there is the reason for the result. And that is because Asa cried, setting for us a model or an example or a type of an activity that you and I as individuals and as a church family need to do as we shift our focus from the people outside the walls of our church, shifting our focus away from the people who are inside the walls of our church, heavenward. Because most important of all is that relationship that finds us continually, day after day, sunrise to sunset, on into the next day, and the day after, and the day after, and the day after, where we continually seek Him. And I happen to believe, if the pattern in the Old Testament is true, and I believe it is, carries over into the New Testament, it's the same mirrored reflection, that God likewise will cause us to prosper in the sense that He will permit us to advance. I don't think any of you, at least from, I can only speak for myself for sure, and I assume the same for the rest of you, that there's not a person in this room that is content to be static. But here's the challenge that I give you for tonight. I want you to think about this. I want you to define for me what the line is between stable and static. Think about that as it relates to your Christian life. Stable or static? Or would you rather advance to go from where you are tonight? And if you think, and if you really believe that you, and I don't say this facetiously, I believe, knowing many of you for a lot of years, I've seen the way marked, like you can get behind over top of an ocean going vessel, and you can track its path where they've come from by the wake that it leaves. And I've seen many of you over the years where you started from, where you were 20 years ago to where you are right now. And you've made some progress. If you've arrived at the point where you are tonight and you are content with the status quo, if you are content being stable, and I'm speaking now individually, stable, and I'm satisfied with stable, I would rather be stable, then please define for me the line between stable and static. And unless I miss my guess, I would probably think that everyone in this room would like to advance from where you are now to where it is that God would have you go, until such time as He says it's time to come home. Is it that there is ever a time in the Christian life where a child of God reaches a pinnacle, can progress no further, and he sits there on the mountaintop waiting for God to call him home? Is there any reality to the opinion held by most, or not by most, but by many people in different areas of Christianity, that when it speaks about growing in grace, it always has in mind an end? It means that there is a point at which any Christian arrives at where they can't possibly grow anymore. They have arrived at the destination that God had intended for them, and be satisfied with that. Do you suppose that that has any legitimacy? Okay. Then I would have you resort to a study of this chapter, and again, pursue for yourself how you would mark from today, say this time next year, to determine visible, objective advancement in the Christian life. How would you be able to tell? If somebody walked up to you with a pure and honest heart and engaged you in conversation and asked you to explain to them, what has God been doing in your life? What has he done in your life this past year? Are you any different today than you were a year ago? And what would you tell them? And then he maybe inquires a little bit deeper, says, well, how do you know that to be true? I know that a lot of that's arbitrary, can be arbitrary, but I just want to say that from my vantage point, my observation point, I've watched over the many years that most of us have been together, and I've seen where you've come from. And in many cases, it's absolutely remarkable. Some of the folks that were most, most noticeable have gone to heaven already. But I remember there's a handful of them already in heaven that I remember when we first began ministry with them. When we yoked up together at Grace Baptist Church, I remember the rough edges and the moldy sleeves and like that, and watched how God transformed people's lives bit by bit by bit, a little bit at a time. And probably unnoticeable to the person, and probably unnoticeable to most people except an intensely interested observer And so I just challenge you with that and ask that we turn our focus heavenward and forever reach up to our God, seeking His face, desiring to move forward in the Christian life in such a way as to please Him.